introduce Miha Kosorog, who works at the Department of Ethnology and Cultural Anthropology at the University of Ljubljana, and is also a researcher at the Institute of Ethnology of the Slovenian Academy of Sciences and Arts. As you've probably seen and guessed, he's a Europeanist anthropologist, and his areas of interest include, which will give you some hint as to why I'm fascinated by his work, the anthropology of space, place, and landscape, but also tourism and festivals, popular culture and music, borders and borderlands, agrarian anthropology, heritage studies and conservation, and human-environment relations. His publications have received a recognition for exceptional achievement by the Slovenian Academy of Sciences, no small achievement. And he has published two monographs, The Anthropology of an Emergent Tourist Destination, Place, Festivals and Local Identity in the Tolminska Region in 2009, and Festival Places, Concepts, Politics and Hope in the Periphery in 2013. Which are, sadly for those who don't speak it, both in Slovenian, but he's also got quite a few publications also in English. And his paper for today, just so I don't waste any more time, is about more recent work, which is part of a multi-species ethnography project and is entitled, unless you've changed it, yes, Border Work with Wildlife on the Slovenian-Hungarian Border at the Intersection of Border and Multi-Species Ethnography. Miha, thank you very much for coming to give us this paper, and over to you.
So thank you. Thank you to Professor Sarah Green. It's a great pleasure and honor to be at this seminar. So in this talk, I'm presenting my recent research of the Slovenian-Hungarian border. My initial aim was to study sustainability of subsistence farming in the border area, but I soon realized that what most farmers talk about is wildlife. Everyone, almost without exception, when asked about the condition and especially the future of local farming, explained that its future is flimsy because red deer and wild boar feast on their fields. The farmer's problem thus also became my research problem. How is that big herbivores are such a huge issue here? As a matter of fact, Slovenian farmers regularly complain about free-living animals, often about wild boars, roe deer, bears, and wolves. Yet complaints of these particular farmers were somehow peculiar. First, red deer is not a common culprit among farmers. As regards problematic species, hence, this area showed specific. Second, what really intrigued me was a recurrent narration that associates animals with the border. When explaining animals' behavior, people depicted many manifestations of the border, which I'll talk about today. Before I continue, let me say a few words about my academic background. This is needed because my research method was not based on extended fieldwork, but on back and forth fieldwork practice, which is common in European ethnology. I started fieldwork in November 2017 and until January 2020 made numerous, usually 1 week long visits into the area, so that altogether I was doing fieldwork for a month and a half. I've been actually for my whole career researching in Slovenia and its neighborhoods. And anthropology at home is, in my academic milieu, quite common. Another of the characteristics of this milieu, which became acute when I started my career a decade ago, is precarity. To earn subsistence, a researcher has to be involved in a number of research projects simultaneously, which stretches her or him between diverse topics and field sites. If you check my articles and books, you'd notice that in the last decade, I've been working on topics as diverse as popular music festivals, recreation in protected areas, youth entrepreneurship, Music in Exile, Hallucinogens, War Heritage, Daily Farming in the Mountains, and more. In other words, at mid-stage of my career, I don't consider myself an expert on anything, but a devotee of many inquiries popping up in more or less serendipitous encounters. Slovenia, how shall I present it for the purpose of this presentation? I'll try to do it with the ingredients that will constitute my case study, that is landscape, wildlife, and identity. Four geographical areas are ascribed to Slovenia. The Mediterranean in the southwest, the Alps in the north, the Dinaric Mountains in the south, and the flat Pannonian Basin in northeast, where I conducted this fieldwork. 58% of the country is covered with forests. I know this is still less than in Finland, yet Pannonia is the least forested and the most agricultural region, colloquially called the Slovenian granary. One half of the total wheat yield and one third of maize is produced there. Big fauna presents a contrast too. Bears and wolves are common in the country, but not in Pannonia. By contrast, here lives the biggest red deer population in the country. Red deer was extinct before the First World War, but started to populate the Pannonian Slovenia from Hungary in the 1970s. The Mura River, which you see on the map, it's in the northeast corner of the country. It's like if you imagine the Slovenia as resembling a chicken, it would be like a necklace of the chicken. The Mura River functions as a barrier for animals' migrations in both directions. Contrast is also historical. The Pannonian Slovenia was before the First World War within the Hungarian part of the monarchy of Austria-Hungary. So if you see on the left map, the chicken head is painted blue. So that was the Hungarian part of the monarchy. The Slovenian-speaking local inhabitants there started to identify as Slovenes at the very late stage, that is in the end of the 19th century, stimulated by nationalists from the Austrian part of the monarchy. However, in Paris negotiations ushering the First World War, the newly established state of Yugoslavia, whose constitutive part was Slovenia, demanded this territory on an ethnic basis. The territorial claims were fulfilled, but with a corrective. For geostrategic reasons, the Slovenian-speaking villages in the Raba Valley, which is on the right map, north from the contemporary Slovenian border, so it is this white spot on the right map, north from Slovenian border. So this Raba Valley was annexed to Hungary. While as a compensation, a kind of compensation, an agreement, few Hungarian-speaking villages were annexed to Yugoslavia also. So that's the dark area in the along the eastern border of Slovenia, so along the Slovenian-Hungarian border within Slovenia. This composition of ethnic minorities and majorities plays a part in how people in the area nowadays explain their problem with wildlife. I conducted fieldwork in the north of the Pannonian Slovenia, an area squeezed between Austria and Hungary. This area is called Goričko, meaning low hills. Since 2003, this is a protected area, the Goričko Landscape Park. My concern was the eastern part of Goričko, the area closer to the Hungarian rather than the Austrian border. This specification is relevant because farmers in western Goričko don't complain about red deer, observing their rarity in contrast to a numerous roe deer population there, whereas in eastern Goričko, along the Hungarian border, complaints about red deer are omnipresent and notorious. My plan now is as follows. I will start with an ethnographic vignette to make the locality of the border and the problem of wildlife palpable. Then I'll present an anthropological dilemma over a symmetrical treatment of humans and animals, particularly in the case of studying borders. Then I'll proceed with ethnography and finish with the historical interpretation of farmers' border work with wildlife. So let's go to the area. On the 4th of November 2019, I visited a farmer in the village of Središče, a village in Slovenia lying alongside the border, most of whose inhabitants are ethnic Hungarians. The Hungarian name of the village is Sebeheli. I visited this farmer for the third time. I announced the visit with a request for a document that back in the early 1990s allowed the local farmers to raise an electric wired fence against wildlife on the edge of their village and right on the border with Hungary. On my arrival, he explained that he can't find the document, probably because he already gave it to some other journalist who didn't bring it back. Instead, to prove to me that he and his companions were right when demanding and raising the fence, he invited me on a journey around the village. So we seated on a tractor and headed eastwards. We exited the village, passed village fields, and reached the border. So you see these wild white pillars on the border. Here was the reason of our journey, which is the fence. So you can see that the fence follows white pillars for some 3 kilometers. At this point, he explained that if we entered Hungary and continued the road for another kilometer or so, we'd reach the village of Magyar Szombatfa. So in this map, it's Soboska Ves, which is a Slovenian name, but actually it's Magyar Szombatfa. You can see it east, on the eastern part of the map. On the right side of the map. Instead, we drove along the 3 kilometer fence along the Slovenian-Hungarian border. So we went instead upwards along the border and then westwards along the border and then returned to the village. On the journey, his explanation of the fence's function continuously mixed with observations of the fence's current state. The explanation of the function was not new to me, because I've already heard the story before from him and other villagers. However, his dwelling perspective in Tim Ingle's meaning of the concept, that is his active engagement with the immediate surroundings on the move, made the border and borderland ecology tangible in a novel way. In other words, while his declared aim was to present objective historical and ecological factors that stimulated the rising of the fence, he was vigilant to their surroundings and discovered various signs along the way. As I later realized, we were there not merely on an excursion, but also exploring something. But let me start with his objective explanations. Between the two sides of the border is a sharp contrast in the landscape. In Slovenia, a cultivated field, in Hungary, a forest. So what you see, that it's a clear field, that's Slovenia, and where you see the forest, that's Hungary on this particular picture. The area that belongs to the village of Središče and which we were investigating is entirely cultivated, with an exception of a small forested plot in the middle of the fields and a forest south from the village. Whereas the landscape we observed across the border was entirely forested. As I realized from many conversations, and my host explained it again, in the socialist Yugoslavia, farmers were allowed to cultivate fields up to the border. So these fields have been persistently maintained until today. In the socialist Hungary, however, the situation was quite different. After the dispute between Yugoslavia and the Soviet bloc in 1948, known as Informbüro, which you might know, so it's the expel of the Yugoslav Communist Party from the International League of Communist Parties, in that time under the leadership of Soviet Union. So after that, the status of this border totally changed. Now it was not merely a state border, but a divide between two inimical socialist worlds. Consequently, the Hungarian regime prohibited the borderland farmers to work in the fields alongside the border. These fields were thus synchronously abandoned by farmers and populated by the state, which brought in new agencies like such as soldiers, guarding dogs, control towers, barbed wires, and more. The Hungarian management of the border was indeed meticulous. From the borderline into the hinterland, several successive ecological belts were created, starting with a belt of overgrown forest, continuing with a tilled soft soil where the army could trace the footprints of escapees from Hungary, and in Goričko, this part is colloquially called the Stalin's garden. Then was a trail for soldiers and space for military equipment, and after that, another belt of forest separated the military zone from the areas intended for farming. This border, in popular terminology known as the Iron Curtain, very much functioned as a curtain, yet not merely an iron one, but also a green one. Besides the military, an ecological composition of forests and clearings discouraged the citizens from leaving the state, as well as prevented a foreign gaze into the state. In order to demonstrate how profoundly the landscape changed on the Hungarian side, my host pointed at two types of the forest, one between his village and the village of Somorodz, to the north, so it's another village to the north of Središće. The other one, the village towards the village of Magyar Szombathva to the east. While the first one, which we see on this picture and here again, is an old forest that's always been there, as people say. The other one is a young, thick forest, which according to him resembles a jungle. He called it Gosha, locally meaning an overgrown forest. The later one is the result of the forced abandonment of fields by Magyar Szombathvas after 1948, as well as further abandonment of the border ecological belt after socialism, which was previously, as I mentioned, cultivated by the army. Before the Iron Curtain, Središće was closely connected with both the neighboring villages in Hungary, so with Somorodz and Magyar Szombathva. People were also kin related. Yet with Magyar Szombathva, in contrast to Somorodz, they were also neighbors in the fields. There used to be a long field stretched between these two villages, and we can see it here, although now it's of course cut with the belt of forest. Neighbors were during agricultural work constantly communicating, although they were since 1919 citizens of different states. With the Iron Curtain and abandonment of fields on the Hungarian side, however, their communication was for several decades cut. This is why in Središće, besides an ecology, people also see a politics in the landscape. Središće is now almost surrounded with forests. A narrow belt of fields stretches only to the west. Farmers explain that it is this anthropogenic and politically induced ecology the reason why their fields gradually became besieged by wildlife. Animals find shelter in the forests, especially the young, thick, self-grown ones, which are the result of the border, and food in their fields. Yet during socialism, heavily guarded and hence populated border prevented animals from hiding there. Whereas after socialism, the border belt was truly abandoned and animals found peace there. For the conclusion of this part, let me grasp this particular border with the tripartite metrics of line, trace, and tide mark proposed by Sarah Green. When the status of the borderline changed from a mere state border into a geopolitical divide, the entire interrelated space was redefined. Its agrarian potential was dropped, while a security potential of an ecology was introduced in Hungary. Yet the change of the borderline unevenly affected the two sides. On the Slovenian side, farmers maintained farming. The tangible trace of the border thus became an environment with contrasting and sharply positioned landscapes, where an animal can jump from a thick shelter directly into a feeding ground. Animals' behavior, consequently, heightens the presence of the border in people's lives. Because when an animal jumps from the forest into the field, it also jumps from one country into another. For inhabitants, however, that's not all. In their view, animals jump because of a particular history of the border. Thus, animals' traces also sustain the memory on this history in people's lives. Now I turn to the dwelling perspective to show how the ecology remains politically charged. I already mentioned that that we were not merely on an excursion. The following issue was at stake. Before I announced my visit, my host received another phone call from a co-villager who informed him that there is a problem with electricity in the border fence. My host replied that he's quite busy at the moment and will check it the next day. But when I phoned and arrived, he found time to examine it immediately. In my opinion, he took advantage of the situation with a name to convince me into a very particular explanation whose interests loom behind a dysfunctional wire. Thus, during our journey, he was constantly looking for proofs about who might stand behind the accident, which he very much associated with the sabotage. At one spot, he pointed at fallen pillars. He asked me to photograph them, saying that now I have evidence and something to write about. I was definitely not on an excursion with a clear political aim, my ascribed role being a reporter who can inform a general public about this farmer's struggle. Namely, at this point, he was totally explicit in whose interest is a dysfunctional fence. It's in the interest of hunters. Indeed, we passed a big number of densely spotted hunting yards, which were another element in the landscape he was exposing as a proof of a unique ecology created in the past with particular interests, but now serving again to particular interests, namely to hunters. Driving on, in one moment, we saw his neighbor in a car approaching our tractor. At a meeting, they spoke in Hungarian, which I couldn't understand. Afterwards, I was explained that the neighbor's aim was to share a few words about the temporary dysfunctional fence, but he also asked my guide whether he knew that hunters built another, a brand new hunting yard in the middle of his cornfield right on the border. This is this one. So you can see on the left side, it's a border pillar. So it's quite close to the border, this one. My host swore to me he didn't know anything about it. And we immediately went to check the yard for allegedly the first time. He was upset, saying that hunters think they can do everything, even build on his property without asking for permission. Indeed, the declared point of the excursion was to give me an objective explanation of local ecology, but that was not all. He also tried to make me aware that the relationships between people are strained precisely because of ecology, that farmers have a good reason for mistrust towards certain other people, and that local landscape remains highly political. They have successfully protected their fields, as they claim the fence is functional, but it is in other people's interest to open their fields again for wildlife from Hungary. I will now summarize the basic components of my research and at the same time connect them with selected anthropological takes on borders and animals. So in the Cold War period, the divergent Hungarian and Yugoslavian management of the border evolved into different border landscapes whose juncture functions as an affordance for wildlife. Affordances, following James Gibson and Tim Ingold, a constituent of the environment that a living being makes use of in the course of its movement, something that enables that being's striving for survival. For animals, the ecological contrast is certainly an affordance. As farmers maintain, they live here, they live there and feed here, a recurrent statement in which there refers to the forested Hungarian borderlands and here to their own fields. Here is, for example, a comment of a farmer in another village at the border explaining this ecological contrast. How shall I evaluate the condition of agriculture in Goričko? Like this, that particularly of 7 hectares, we harvest 2, 3, with wildlife devastating around 3 hectares. Because over there, that is Hungary, and there's a lot of wildlife. This is an area with a lot of it. It's exactly this area that is problematic. Red deer and wild boar, you know how it is. It's normal. They come if there are only forests in the Hungarian side. From there, they come to feed here. They feed here and live there, in their forests. Over there, it is, how shall I say, virtually abandoned. Many people emigrated in the past during socialism, which of course means that many villages are abandoned. Normally, wildlife has peace there. It procreates there and comes to feed here. Such an affordance, however, engenders particular relationships among people, like between farmers and hunters. These agents engage with the landscape differently, but because this takes place on the border, their engagement with the landscape also includes the border. An example is building fences and creating corridors for animals. In anthropology, such practical engagement with a border, be it material or mental, which brings a border into people's life, is known as border work. Steff Jansen defines it as practices that produce, reproduce, or modify degrees of borderness. In Green's words, is the way the border appears, disappears, and reappears in the course of everyday life. It's what makes a place feel borderly. And Madeline Reeves, for her, it's messy, contested, and often intensely social business of making territory integral. Hence, whatever people do with borders, either they conceptualize, talk about, or do things with them, they perform a certain kind of border work. When people in Goričko talk about wild animals' behavior, they almost as a rule evoke the border. First, it represents the contrast between now and the past. When people say that the socialist border prevented animals from movement, whereas the European permeable border introduced more movement. Second, the border is the core reason for their contemporary condition. For example, they can't properly affect the wildlife management across the border. Hence, their striving for a better life on the border has a clear limit, which is the border. The border hence functions as a core agent in local relationships. For animals, it appears as an affordance. For humans, it represents the source of problematic species and consequently problematic relationships among them. Since we are dealing with an entanglement of humans, animals, and borders, how shall we approach it anthropologically? Multi-species ethnography is an attractive option. Yet, a multi-species ethnography of borders has so far been rare. Yet, some models exist. First, applicative ecological studies of borders are rising. At the 2003 World Park Congress, Benefits Beyond Boundaries, borderlands became recognized as center for trans-border safeguard projects. In a similar spirit, the former Iron Curtain was protected as the European Greenbelt, whose part is also the Goričko Landscape Park and the adjoining Őrség National Park in Hungary. The latter even owns, the former border belt, which transformed from a military to a conservation zone. However, parks are primarily concerned with rare species, and in their perspective, the border is precious as a haven of biodiversity. This line of thought, therefore, can't help us much or can't take us far with our kind of problem. A very different approach was recently implemented by anthropologists analyzing the spread of African swine fever, supposedly from Georgia via Russia westwards. It is a deadly disease that transmits between and kills both domestic and wild pigs. In Goričko too, hunters were very concerned when gossip spread that it reached Hungary. To protect their swine populations, some European countries have implemented new border regimes, whereas Poland announced building a fence all along its border with Belarus. This led some anthropologists, and I'm referring here to the bewildering boar project. Some anthropologists to parallel moving animals with migrating humans. According to their explication, countries were declaratively rising borders against wildlife, but the biopolitics was in fact targeting migrating people. This approach is instructive because how people or how political discourse narrates and imagines animals affects people's border work. Red deer in Goričko, for example, sometimes has a foreign nationality. It is a Hungarian deer. Yet in our case, it is not only an allegorical animal. It is an animal that leaves material traces along the border. It materializes the border as a living creature. Multi-species ethnography urges us to focus on such living creatures and relationships between them and humans. As our companions, animals have an agency on their own. Therefore, they should be treated on a symmetrical ground with humans. They both deserve an equal analytical status, the status of purposefully acting living beings. But since in our case, it is not only animals who act and make people act, but it is in the first place the border which makes animals act, I decided for an ant or actor network approach. Namely, besides animals, ant also recognizes other entities as agentive. Ant defines any entity that makes another entity act a mediator. The border, whose agency cannot be denied because it makes animals migrate across it for food and shelter, it is such a mediator. And animals too are mediators because they stimulate human border work. Anthropologist Hilary Cunningham, herself not an ant theorist, but a prominent advocate of the study of non-human life as integral to any border, proposes to stay attentive to the discursive aspects of ecological boundaries, while at the same time take matter seriously as a causative agent. This was a quotation. Yet, to take at the same time both matter and discourse seriously can create a problem. Namely, when we follow the connections let's say, out there, that is, which mediator made another act, we end up with a different association of humans, animals, and things than in the case we follow the connections that our interlocutors point at. For example, before I said that the border made animals move, yet it was not the border, but affordances. As a border, it was only perceived by humans. In the interlocutor's life world, hence, animals make people act, and animals are clearly connected with the border. Yet in the world out there, these relationships are not such, because only humans have the concept of border, whereas animals follow affordances. Animals do make humans perform border work, but as soon as we are talking about border work, we have to change a post-humanist for a humanist approach. Border can put humans into relation with itself because it is part of the human world, but it can't put animals, except as a specific ecology that is an outcome of a border. So to avoid a double vision, we should either focus on the world out there in order to recognize animals' intentions, or, since they don't have the concept of border, which we have, transfer the analysis into people's worldview. That we can't do both these analysis simultaneously was already noticed by Steph Jansen, who intended to research a border by treating its material components on an equal ground with human discourse, but failed. Jansen thus concluded, human practices could not be understood without tracing how they congealed around things which compose a border, like wires and so on, mines and so on. But ultimately, none of these particular things were necessary conditions in the making of this border, while human border work was. Therefore, a researcher has to decide what to analyze, mediators or border work, or she can interchangeably apply these approaches. For example, at the first stage, border is a human product before there was no border. At the second stage, borderline functions as a limitation and stimulation for an ecology of relations whose part is also wildlife. And here animals and things can be treated on a symmetrical ground with humans, that is, as mediators. Yet at the third stage, again, when animals stimulated more and more border work, one has to recognize that this work is an exceptionally human activity. There is no border work of wildlife, only with wildlife. So let's now stop at the third stage and let me examine the complexity of such border work. As we've noticed on the journey to the area of Sredishche, when my host was explaining how a specific ecology of the border functions, he was referring to everyday experience, memories, and politics. We've learned that ecology is highly politicized, on the one hand due to the particular history, on the other due to strained relationships between farmers and hunters. Let me pause on this very last issue now. At first sight, it's not very anthropological to juxtapose people of two occupations as monoliths, because they are not. Farmers also hunt, and some professional hunters cultivate a garden or a field. Nonetheless, I could frequently hear farmers blaming hunters and vice versa. But let me now leave hunters alone and delve into farmers' perception of this relationship. To do so, however, I have to go back in history again. In the introduction, I mentioned that the Pannonian Slovenia is the most agricultural region of the country. It is also the most underdeveloped in terms of economic and social measures. Goričko, however, is underdeveloped even in the context of the Pannonian Slovenia. Until the 1970s, there was no industry, this was an entirely agricultural area. As regards farming, it hasn't been prosperous either. It surely isn't part of the granary of Slovenia, like the rest of Pannonian Slovenia, because its hilly terrain doesn't allow large plots of land, but patchy mosaic of fields, meadows, grasslands, marshlands, and forests. Goričko thus remained an area of family subsistence farming until today. Yet in the 1960s, many young people migrated for work to larger centers in Slovenia or abroad, mainly to Austria and Germany. Because the interest for farming was rapidly declining, a farming cooperative searched for an alternative economy. They found it in hunting tourism. In 1964, the cooperative registered a hunting reservoir in the north part of Goričko, along the Hungarian border. Initially, it specialized for pheasant and small game hunt. In the 1970s and especially 80s, its focus changed. First roe deer, then wild boar, and soon also fallow deer and red deer hunt was promoted in the reservoir. Meanwhile, and still in the time of Yugoslavia, local farming cooperative disbanded and the hunting ground became a state-run hunting ground. Its guests were foreign tourists, and in Yugoslavia, trophy hunt was a significant means of foreign currency inflow. Moreover, when farmers gave up farming, the hunting ground expanded into the abundant agricultural land. Why I'm telling you this history? Historically, hunting was bolstering simultaneously as farming was weakening. In farmers' perception, however, hunting was bolstering on behalf of their decline and with the help of their work. For the remaining farmers, it is themselves who feed wild herbivores while hunters win profits. Hunters regularly excuse that they can't do much about wildlife because it migrates from Hungary. This is obvious also to farmers. Yet the latter also considers such explanation a tricky form of hunters' border work. For farmers, the bordering hunters' conduct functions as a double bind. On the one hand, it is an excuse for their inactivity because they can always refer to the border as the limit of their authority. On the other, the uneven ecology at the border is a source of red deer from Hungary, which they capitalize. Moreover, farmers also perceive hunters as privileged in relation to the state. The state runs the hunting ground. The state granted the estimation of animal-made damage in the fields to hunters, and the state presumably earns more from hunting than from their farming. As one lady bitterly said, we feed the state. According to her, the state makes profit from farmers' work, albeit indirectly. So that is by selling access to the hunt of trophy animals, which they feed. Indeed, in farmers' perception, the local future of hunters looks much brighter as their own. But let me now conclude. For farmers, big herbivores are powerful agents. Behind the border in the Raba Valley, Goričko farmers observe tangible proof of their power. Animals have been populating abundant farmlands there already for many decades. Neighborhood across the border, however, also proves that animals can be quite political. According to a local story in Goričko, animals were populated there intentionally by the Hungarian socialist regime. As the story goes, the aim of the regime was to uproot the Slovenian minority along the border. Here's the story I recorded in the very north of Goričko. In 1950s, there were very few big game, maybe a roe deer here and there, but many rabbits and only few pheasants. Then they populated hoof game. In Hungary, this was a planned activity. The regime populated the game. I had relatives in Hungary, and my relative was even present when wild boars were delivered with a train from Russia to Szentendre. Then they populated them all around the Rava Valley. They brought them and let them go with the aim to make people leave the border area. Wild boar caused damage to the fields and forced people to abandon the land and leave. So this is the end of quotation. My host in Središče, the one who took me with the tractor, told me another variant of the same story. Partridge was here and wild rabbit. Here and there, a few roe deer, but red deer, perhaps two pairs in the whole district. Wild boar, they didn't know. Wild boars were, I don't know if this is true, but it's what my godfather, a hunter, told me, that allegedly that crazy Janos Kadar, so he was leader of Hungary from 1956 to 1988, so that Kadar wanted to, in this way, to eradicate those Rava Valley Slovenes to make them leave. So he brought wild boars, young. This reproduced on such a level that really, I don't know what's the truth, because these truths were totally isolated, end of quote. Indeed, farmers across Europe often ascribe huge potency to wildlife, yet not always so directly connected with the state politics. In the case of Goričko, its political background is paramount. A look across the border, which is another form of farmers' border work, proves that farmers are vulnerable and that it is often in someone else's interest how their livelihood will turn. As they lament, the future of Goričko is certainly not agricultural. One farmer concluded our interview, return after a decade or so, and you'll find the place empty of people here. Only wildlife has a future here. In sum, much of their border work with animals, like rising fences, comparing borderlands, negotiating with hunters and the state to make the territory integral, is an expression of vulnerability and marginality of small subsistence farmers in the periphery of the state. Thank you very much. And
thank you. You can probably stop. Reference.
Just to mention, so I published something from this fieldwork already, but what I presented today, the ethnography that I presented today is not included in this paper, but some of the claims are. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We've already got a few questions coming up. I found it very interesting and fascinating, both parallels and differences with, as you can imagine, with some of the work that I've done. I'll just start with one question here regarding, while people are finding their questions, though I've already got a couple waiting. One is about the agency question, which you brought up halfway in the middle here, about the interaction between, I guess, what's happening at the state level, where you've got forests and abandoned villages on one side and continued agriculture on the other side, which a kind of situation that also occurred on the Greek-Albanian border, but the other way around, really. On the other hand, conspiracy theories about the introduction of wild animals to have certain effects and so on. So, and you mentioned that, what was the quote? Yeah, no border work of wildlife, only with wildlife. So obviously the animals are not doing the border work, it's people. The question here really is whether you see that all coming together as in kind of actor network theory terms, sort of as assemblage or as a singularity, everything congealing into some effect, overall effect, or perhaps that there's more than one kind of discourse in Cunningham's terms going on here simultaneously, which sometimes come together and sometimes don't. So you've got ecological theory, which would have the idea of habitats and niches, which would create certain kinds of borders. And then you've got political policy, which places borders in a different place, that's the ones that you had actually marked. So whether you'd see that your work was sort of a kind of clash or bringing together of these different discourses, or whether it they can also work in parallel. Not sure whether I'm making myself clear here, but so that's one question. And in the meantime, then we've got a couple of others, first from Igor, then from Anni.
Shall I try to answer to this?
Sure, one? Sure.
Okay. Thank you very much. So yeah, basically what I'm doing is I don't try to stick to one theory. I don't try to stick to one kind of explanation of what is going on in the border. And for sure, I think that this, as you mentioned, like political, ecological, and so on, could be used in parallel. But in a way, it was a kind of a, for me, it was a kind of a maybe more like an intellectual challenge, how to use this end theory and how far does it bring me. Because I can't say that I know this theory really well, that I'm an expert on end theory. What I know, it's few studies that of animals, for example, that Helen Kopnina mentions somewhere, and like Kelly on mosquitoes. So basically, I used the work of Bruno Latour and his explanation in reassembling the social. And what he proposes is that we should pay attention to our interlocutors. So what kind of networks our interlocutors point at, and what kind of assemblages they point at. And on the other hand, what many, at least in my perception, end theorists are doing, that they indeed follow what is, let's say, out there, not what interlocutors point. So for me, this creates two networks, two quite different networks. This was kind of a interesting thing to point out. So it was not very, and I was actually happy that when I discovered this Janssen's article and found it, that he found it interesting too. But I would say I was not probably very clear, but I usually panic when I get questions, so don't judge me too harsh, please.
No. That makes it a lot clearer, and I'd like to follow up on it, but there are some questions piling up now. So next question from Igor Mikishin.
Mikishin, thank you, Miha, for your fascinating talk. And for quoting all the right people, I appreciate a lot. I would like to start my question with this very short anecdote. When my mom was a little girl, she lived in a house with her family back in Uzbekistan, in Soviet Uzbekistan, and she had a dog, and that dog was her favorite thing and everything, but she had a strange habit of going to the toilet to the neighboring yard. Although the neighbors loved the dog, they didn't mind to clean after the dog, but that was kind of the case. She always went to do the toilet thing to the neighbors. So here's my question. Actually, when you have animals, they can be perceived as a natural resource, or at the same time, if they do harm to your economy in some way, like they eat your crops or they do something else of that kind, they can also be considered a burden. So I was thinking, is there a narrative maybe you encountered that about the belonging of animals? For instance, if you put a border and some particular animals cannot come to your land and do something good, for instance, they used to nest there or to breed there or benefit you somehow, or on the contrary, if you don't have a steady border, they come to your land and destroy your crops or do something else, or you hunt our animals and your filthy animals come to destroy our crops or something of that kind. Is there a narrative that the animals sort of belong to some particular country as a natural resource, and other countries on the other side of the border exploit our natural resource, or like stop exploiting if we build the border, something of that kind, if you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand, yeah. So first of all, it certainly is, because as I mentioned, there is this landscape park or nature park, which of course considers certain animals as, let's say, as a treasure, of, as a national treasure probably, because for example, there is a otter population in Goričko, which they are, I mean, let's say that the country is proud of, and even the of course, the park is proud of, many butterflies, many other insects, and many birds. So this is one narrative that is very prominent for that region. Whereas for the big herbivores, like, and especially for the for red deer, I don't know if probably you don't know that Hungary has a very huge population of red deer. So if you type into, let's say, YouTube, red deers in Hungary, you will get very interesting videos about how they migrate over the country. And in this case, actually, because the number of red deers in Hungary is so huge, I talked to the Hungarian hunters. They don't, for them, they don't consider it a loss if a few animals go across the border, and if they are also, let's say, if they are the reservoir for the Goričko hunting ground. On the other hand, there is this narrative that these animals belong to Hungary and that they should also stay there, which is especially prominent, as I said, among farmers, who also a few years ago made a political kind of association to be stronger on the higher levels, and even convinced the Slovenian Ministry of Agriculture to negotiate their situation with the Hungarian, of course, Ministry of Agriculture. So there is, I answered your question, but it is the narrative. There are narratives about that animals belong to certain places and they should. Yeah. Although we all know that, yeah, they are free living animals.
Okay, thank you. We've got three more questions coming. Anni, then Timo, then Andy.
Hi. Okay, thank you, Miha, very much for the interesting talk. I'm Anni and I teach here at Helsinki. And I apologize in advance that I'll have to leave a bit early, but it's good that I had time to get my question in. And it might be a bit naive because this is not my field at all, but when you were talking about the border work, humans doing the border work, and it just made me think immediately of this classic question, do animals work? And I was thinking about animals doing border work and how it's different from this human border work. Like animals do have a concept of territory and they mark their territory and they defend their territory, and how you would see that as different from this border work that the humans are doing. And then if you think of this classic arguments that animals and humans, they dwell in the same way. How does this work on work and dwelling go together? So animals and humans, like Ingold's argument that animals and humans, they actually dwell in the same way. how does the work on borders or other territorial work fit in this dwelling perspective?
Thank you very much. We can agree that both humans and animals work, and that both have that they are both territorial. Although I don't see these territories or the notion of territory, whatever, or the perception of territory that equals. I mean, the perception of territory equals among non-human and human animals. And it's the same with the border, of course. I mean that, of course, we, as I mentioned, that for example, this Mura River functions as a kind of a border, a natural border. I mean, a border that animals don't migrate very much across that river. But I don't believe that animals have the concept of border. I don't believe that animals have. They have certain histories. I believe that they can learn. I believe that they can learn through socialization in a way that they learn in which places to go, which tracks to go, as Ingold mentions. I think that Ingold very much pushes forward this argument and very much neglects the conceptual part or the historical part, how awareness of certain histories, how values and such things that are socialized are. I think that he's too reductive on this, dwelling perspective. So that's why I prefer to combine it with more historical approach or ecological also and so on. I mean, differently ecological than in his view. So to answer shortly, no, I don't believe that animals' territory and human territory is something equal. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Very interesting. Timo Kartinen.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Timo Kartinen. I'm one of the professors of anthropology here, and I wanted to thank you for a very thought-provoking and very clear argument you're making here. This is, I think, an observation which I wanted to see if you would agree with it or if I had followed your argument in the right way. But it seems to me that that farmers and hunters would by nature be allies with each other, not opponents. And it seems to me that what you're saying is the fact that there is a border makes them kind of like having opposed interests. And I started to think about this when you showed the picture with the mosaic of the fields and small forests where normally, if you think about the animal habitat, you would expect that the game animals would stay in those small woods. But now with the border and with the history of the border, they would have this much larger wild area to dwell in. And so I was wondering if you think this could be a rather more general effect of the borders, because I could also think about an example from northern Finland, where in the Russian side, you have a very large wildlife refuge or like nature conservation area, and it seems that all the bears and wolves kind of come over to the Finnish side, but then they go back to that large woods area without staying in Finland. So they don't it sort of appears as if animals somehow recognize the border, which is probably because there is a larger sort of habitat for them on the Russian side. But one effect of this is that there is kind of almost automatically contention among people on the Finnish side about whether it's a good or a bad thing that they come, because some people make a living, for instance, from showing the bears to tourists, and others don't like this a bit. So I'm just wondering if you're making a rather more general argument here by saying this.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, I think that I don't know much about the situation in Finland, but I mean the relations between farmers and hunters are often strained, I would say. I agree with you that in many of such cases, borders are an issue, and even in the places that are not close to the border, becomes an issue, because, for example, I can think of again in Slovenia, but probably elsewhere too, in the Alps. Now the big problem, that farmers talk about is wolf, and bears and so on, and it's always this discourse that these bears arrived across the border, so that they are kind of migrants from the Balkans. So it's always the issue of border that is brought in, and thank you very much for this insight or for this comment, so that but probably Sarah has also worked on this much more than me with animals and borders in this kind of context. I hope I answered to the question.
Sure, thank you.
Not necessarily, but there's some interesting things there as well. But moving on then to Andy Graham.
Hi, thanks very much for this really interesting talk. And I have to say, especially as an anthropologist who conducts research in Macedonia, I enjoyed the way in which you contextualized the border within a political history of Yugoslavia, and of course the rift between Yugoslavia and Comintern. But as I was listening to the talk, I couldn't help but think that since 2004, both Slovenia and Hungary have been part of the European Union. And so while you point out the agency of deer, of hunters, of the socialist Yugoslav state, of the socialist Hungarian state, and of the current border as a relic of the rift between socialist Hungary and socialist Yugoslavia, I was a little curious about what I felt was perhaps maybe a missing agency, for instance, that of the European Union, but also of the Hungarian state today and of the Slovenian state today, rather than they seemed to appear in the talk as I was listening to it, mostly in the form of a ghostly presence of their socialist predecessors. And so this leads me then to two questions. The one is maybe a little more concrete and the other is a little more abstract. But the first more concrete one is, so what of the European Union in this ethnographic tale that you're spinning? And what about the Slovenian and the Hungarian states today? And secondly, this is the little more abstract one. Noticing the sort of the absence of the European Union in your ethnographic analysis, I couldn't help but wonder, can a political entity like the European Union do border work through its absence?
Border work too?
Through its absence.
Thank you very much. So, yeah, that's true. Yeah. So the thing is that European Union is kind of present in this area, but especially as via this trans-border projects, so kind of different kinds of projects, and usually as regards wildlife, this is a conservation project. So it's because we have these two parks that are joining on the border. This is the Ježek Park and this Goričko Park, and they constantly collaborate. Whereas their collaboration is targeting, as I mentioned, very different species of animals. So. The other thing is the two states, as I said, there was an initiative coming from the bottom up to the Slovenian Ministry of Agriculture to intervene and to do something about this. But that was very recently. And I actually made an interview with representatives of the Ministry of Culture on this issue. But that was just before COVID. It was like just when, I don't know, I returned in January back home and then went to do this interview. So it was just before that, and that was something in progress. So then probably it stopped, I don't know. I didn't quite understand the last thing you asked me about European Union. Its role as a border work, you mentioned, yeah.
And I can elaborate a little bit. So one parallel that I had in mind is within a lot of work on neoliberalism, for example, there's an argument that the withdrawal of the state nonetheless exerts some type of influence, agency, force on social life, so that all of a sudden subjects have to become self-managing or something like this. So an argument about how absence nonetheless has some kind of social agency. And I was just curious, just as you think about this material, whether it might make sense to have a parallel argument in terms of a political entity like the EU, perhaps acting and doing border work precisely by not being active.
I have to be honest, I didn't think about that, and I have to be even more honest, I don't, I should check better about this European politics in regard to wildlife, because I should say that that's something I was not really studying so far, so perhaps this should be, thanks for your you encouraged me to do so. Yeah, thanks a lot, but I can't comment on this very much.
Thank you. I've got a couple of other questions. Has anybody else got questions you'd like to ask? Mari? Yeah, she has a question.
Yeah, hi. Really fascinating paper. Always makes me think about Estonia as well, and all the wolves coming from Russia always. But actually, I had a kind of an invitation for you to elaborate a little bit more on the Chicken Head region. I noticed it was actually quite small in its diameter, and I was wondering what is happening at this other border areas there. You mentioned that it's only kind of the eastern side, and what is happening with migration situation or other ways that borders are felt. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, yeah. So first, this region, it's, as far as I found out, I mean, talking with farmers also in the other parts of this eastern border, this part is quite specific. I mean, it's quite specific precisely because of this ecology, precisely because this eastern part of Goričko started to be abandoned quite earlier than the western part, which is much more cultivated even today. So that also these patches of forest spread around Goričko, so it functions much, much better also. Of course, it's not the thing that just animals just migrate across the border, but they also live there. This is obvious. In the other areas of this, they're quite different because, again, landscape in the lowlands, it is flatland, and it stretches as such across the border to Hungary. And we have to bring in history. In the Hungarian socialist Hungary, the flatland was collectivized, and whereas these pockets of hilly areas, you know, around the country were not collectivized, and they could be used by individual farmers, like in Yugoslavia. And the collectivized land, so the huge properties, were afterwards privatized and bought by sometimes in this area also like some foreign farmers from Austria in this case, which I know. So the thing is that these huge properties were very early fenced with barbed wire and so on, which was non-economical, at least as farmers told me, for the small plots of land in the Goričko region, so for these patches of fields. So this is another ecological dimension which I couldn't present before, but it's quite interesting, so that animals don't feed so much on these huge properties because they are fenced, whereas they do in this area where supposedly do, as people say. I hope I at least a bit answered, but the rest of Slovenia, of course, the landscape is quite diverse, you know, so you have somewhere mountains and so on, so it's different, also different species of wildlife. Hello, Pirjo.
Hi, that's the next questioner is Pirjo.
Yeah, hello, Miha, it's very good to see you here. And thanks so much for your for presenting your materials and for your analysis. So you were applying actor network theory very nicely. I loved it how you put it together with the historical background of this region, because as we know, actor network theory has been criticized that it doesn't take into account the historical issues enough. So you were combining these two things very nicely. But I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit more on multi-species relations, because you talked about accidental jumps of the red deers and so on. But I was wondering, like, how are the movements related to the other animals, other species? For instance, seasonal movements of the animals and so on. So could you elaborate a bit more on that? Thanks. Mm-hmm.
So if I understand your question correctly, it is so the if you talk about like human animal relations in this case, it's something of course very different as you are studying, and so what animals represent, what these animals represent to farmers is pest animals, so they're not really relating with them, but they're more like or their relationship is kind of full of anger, let's say. For hunters, it's a different thing. But you mentioned like multi-species, also in the sense that among different species, so how they relate with each other. Well, I can't say much about this because, again, I didn't study that enough, probably. I asked hunters about what's the migration, how the migration of red deer goes into new areas, and that was something quite interesting for me. But in this case, what I found out is that it doesn't migrate so fast as we might think, or as it is usually said that wild boars migrate quite fast, but not red deer, for example. But I don't know if this how the migration of these animals is interconnected. This is something I can't say much. I don't know if that was a question, Pierre. Sorry.
Yeah, good. I was just thinking maybe farmers and hunters, they have some ideas like how the movements of the deers are connected to the movements of some other animals.
That's true, yeah. So they're quite familiar about where, for example, they can take you into the woods and show you where the red deer is, or they can tell you come at 4 o'clock in the morning and we will go this spot and you will find them there. So they are, yes, they are quite familiar with certain spots where animals stay, and they also have ideas about, they also know about their migration, of course, how the young deers occupy new territories and so on. Yeah, they know this, yeah. But I can't tell you more. I mean, it's more like it's about also about. So the most common thing they talk about is how deer or the other animal enters the field, destroys, and so on, and how even some certain obstacles don't help much, and so on. So this is the most regular debate among them about the animals.
Thank you. We're getting towards the end, but I have one kind of question. Those people who know what I've been up to lately, I've become very interested in wild boar conspiracy theories. And in my travels around the Mediterranean region before the lockdown, I got a whole series of different types of conspiracy theories about why there had been this huge increase in wild boar. In various different parts, in Italy, in Israel, in Beirut and Lebanon, in Tunis, in Egypt. They have been increasing everywhere, but there's different theories about what caused it. And so I've just heard a new one from you now. And what I got interested in that is, when looking, comparing, say, what the Italians in Calabria said about their wild boar and the conspiracy about what caused them to be there, and compare that with what the Lebanese said, that you could connect it to political conditions. So in the Italian case, the accusation was that some very rich mafiosi had introduced them in order to destroy the land so as to buy it up cheap. And in Lebanon, the accusation was that they had come from Israel-Palestine and they were drugged by the Israelis and dumped on the Lebanese side, where they would wake up and then cause trouble on the Lebanese side. And your theory seemed to imply something connected to the fact that the border you were looking at was a past Cold War border. And that intrigued me because, you know, do you think this was a Cold War conspiracy theory or a nationalist one?
That's interesting, yeah. So I tried to find out if this conspiracy theory is if I could hear it, or I could hear from people also on the other side of the border, which I couldn't. So, also when I mentioned to some people, I mean, this story, they didn't hear it before. And they have others conspiracy theories there too, but they're different. They're not about this Soviet war. I think that is from the time of Yugoslavia, so that it's not a new one, that it's not after, that it's something that was around already then. Talking to Slovenian hunters in Goričko, they told me that they have been discussing this story also with the Hungarian farmers, and whether it's true that it, in the times they brought these boars and so on, and they only laughed and so on. So I think this story has been around for a while, and it's very much from the same repertoire as like this Stalin's Garden, for example, which I mentioned. And because after Yugoslavia, there was not much talk about Hungary as part of the larger world that is let's say, kind of ruled from faraway Russia. Whereas in this story, it's quite explicit that they were brought from Russia, which is for me quite interesting detail. You know, so I think that it's from that it's quite that it's earlier. Yeah, that it's part of this same narration as this Stalin's garden and so on. So they were, I mean, they when they talk about this border, they like to talk about the border that used to be between Yugoslavia and Hungary. This is a topic that they like to tell stories about how people migrated across, how escapees come from to this area, how, for example, soldiers were all the time present, how these military control towers were densely spotted on the Hungarian side. And they like to compare the two sides. So but this is probably quite common in the when one studies borders ethnographically, people remember such, let's say, more harsh borders in relation to the new one, that it's actually more like a, let's say, more like a kind of a heritage. It's more heritageized today. It's kind of, there are a lot of pets, you know, for recreation and so such things around. So it has a completely different spatial appearance, I would say. So yeah, I think that this is a part of that. And also, when they noticed that the population of wild boar increased, that was in the 1960s. So in the 1960s, it increased, and probably it was part of the same, comments about what was going on. Because that's another thing that they like to remember, you know, how they burned these fires near the fields, or how they went to protect fields, young guys physically there, staying and drinking and so on. So this is something that's quite interesting too. I hope I at least...
No, that did. I mean, what's intriguing about what you're saying is how little the concept of nationality or ethnicity seems to be coming into that argument. And we're just getting towards the end now. I did have a question about the trace, but that would get us into Derrida. It would take far too long. One thing just reminded before you were talking about Hunter and hunting, and it reminded me of some things that Frederick Keck, who's been studying avian influenza and bird flu and around the world, and he comes up with this phrase, kinegetic power. He was talking about the difference between the way hunters understand the relation between themselves and non-human entities, which includes birds and viruses, and the way, say, scientists or nationalists do. The hunter always has to assume the coexistence, the necessary coexistence of the other entities within the environment, whereas the nationalist tries to completely exclude, right? So there's a different notion of landscape and territory and its use. The Keck's suggesting that this kind of hunter-hunted relation is always one of coexistence and codependence, whereas the more nationalist approach towards territory might be more exclusionary, so that the idea of the only one kind of thing existing on one side and a different thing existing on the other. In any case, we are completely out of time. I've enjoyed this very much. Thank you so much, and I hope we have an opportunity to invite you to Helsinki at some point in the future to continue the conversation. I'm just sorry for now that we couldn't have you over because of the situation.
Thank you so much for having me at your seminar. Yeah. And I really enjoyed it. It's, as I said, huge pleasure and honor to be your guest. So thank you very much, and I hope to see you around again.
Yeah, thank you. And I hope you have a good weekend. And we can't, you won't be able to hear us go. But thank you. This was our last seminar of this year, actually, and it was a great way to end it.